once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I've noticed that you didn't say boys and girls. You realize that the boys and girls run screaming from the room when they hear the bagpipes.
I knew I skipped something there, and I couldn't. My brain went on hold there for a minute.
Yeah.
As I reverted back to Idabellian thought processes. And if today is Saturday, May 23rd, where you are, then you may give us a call in here at 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400. However, we shall warn you, when you call in, you will not be able to hear us on the telephone. You will have to turn the radio up slightly. Please listen
for
feedback.
But not too high, because you'll actually get feedback if you turn it up too high, because we can, I don't know. It's weird.
Things are broken so often around here that if they're ever fixed, we won't know what to do.
There's an absolutely fascinating bill in the Senate that says something about the political situation that'll probably get me in trouble when I acknowledge it. But I'm going to say it anyway. There's a bill been introduced by Elizabeth Warren and a Senator Vinton, I think his name is. Let's see if I can get his correct name in here. Yes, David Vitter. And Elizabeth Warren jointly introduced a bill limiting the ability of the Federal Reserve to loan money or take action financially to support companies in the event of a financial crisis. And that irony that drips from that in so many places that I have to mention it. Elizabeth Warren is arguably one of the two most left-wing liberal socialist senators currently residing in that house of interesting people. David Vitter is arguably one of the most right-wing Tea Party favorite members of that organization, and they both agree that they don't like the Federal Reserve. Now, talking about interesting, fascinating bedfellows, in my experience, when the two extremes don't like something, it's generally a pretty good idea to hang on to it.
I think they're missing a major point, though.
But there's also another thing, one other idea I want to throw in here.
Okay.
It's a data point, and we can discuss this. And that is, this week the CIA released the reading material and a speech that was written by Osama bin Laden, apparently shortly before his timely demise. And apparently he is also an opponent of the Federal Reserve and is convinced that it is evil incarnate upon the earth, or was. So we now know that Al-Qaeda, the far left wing, and the far right wing all equally hate the Federal Reserve, which almost is a reason to say it should be strengthened or something. Anyway, that's just...
Right. Okay, so the Federal Reserve is often called, in the economic circles, the lender of last resort.
Yes.
That's kind of the definition of the major thing that they do. In the event of an emergency, they step in and make a loan. In this case, in the 2007 to 2009 don't even know what to call it. Nobody.
I'm going to call it the Panic of 2008.
We call it the beginning of the Great Recession.
I just call it the Panic of 2008.
Okay. The Fed stepped in and made loans, two big loans, to Bear Stearns and to AIG. The money that it made off of those loans, because then took Bear Stearns and ripped it apart and sold it to the other big brokerage firms out there, the big Wall Street firms. The money that it made from that, it turned around and gave back to the United States Congress so that we have a low deficit. They're still making money off of that. AIG is still paying them large amounts of money for that loan. And Elizabeth Warren is very anti-bailouts, and David Vitter is very anti-bailouts. But as I said, in 2008, while this was going on, this is the worst bailout that I can imagine. A bailout, in my opinion, would be if your boat is sinking, you've got a hole in the boat, and you have a bucket, and there's people in the boat with you, and you all start using your hands or your buckets, and you're bailing the boat out. We're helping each other to, and we're not expecting anything except for making the boat float. The loans to AIG and Bear Stearns were at shark rates at the beginning. The Federal Reserve came in and said, pay us or we're going to break your kneecaps. They actually had to come back in later and lower the interest rate that they were charging AIG because AIG was almost going out of business from the bailout. So the concept that we should limit the Federal Reserve from being the lender of last resort, which is what it is, it's in the event of a massive emergency, one that could take out the economy, having someone out there to step in and say, all right, let's slow down the process. Because a train wreck at slow speeds doesn't kill people. A train wreck at high speeds kills a lot of people. And in the economy, that makes a lot of sense. If we look around and we say Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and AIG all went at the same time, we would still be in a depression. Because it wouldn't have stopped there. It would have gone on and on and on. The fact that they could step in and make the loans that they did to AIG and Bear Stearns was proven to be effective because they didn't make the same loans, because it wasn't popular and people called it bailouts. They didn't make the same loan to Lehman Brothers. And Lehman Brothers failed. And nobody thought that was going to happen. Even the Federal Reserve said, no, they'll figure something out. The reason why we have a Federal Reserve is because J.P. Morgan, way back in 1907, we didn't have a Federal Reserve at that point. The economy was collapsing. It's funny that 100 years later, almost to the T is when this happens, J.P. Morgan's with personal money stepped in and started making these loans, and then he went to the U.S. Congress and said, get your act to...
No, the Congress was not in session.
No, I'm not talking about right away. Okay. He went to U.S. Congress and said, get your act together. You need to get a bank so that I don't have to be doing this all the time. And it didn't happen right away. So it wasn't like Congress came back and paid back J.P. Yeah. Morgan for this. J.P. Morgan wound up making a lot of money. It'd be like Warren Buffett doing it today. And Warren Buffett's job is not to save the economy of the United States. We need a bank to do that.
And it's more than interesting. We have experimented with abolishing the Federal Reserve. We did that in Andrew Jackson effectively did it in 1837, and we had arguably the worst depression in the history of the United States that followed, which was probably the primary causative effect to the Civil War. The fact that the Federal Reserve was peppered with very, very conservative governors in the late 1920s. When I say very, very conservative, they were very much of the opinion, they were deeply conservative Republicans, and were very much of the opinion that they should not step in and do the kind of things the Federal Reserve did this time around.
Right.
And as a result,
we have the Great Depression.
We have, even as the economy was collapsing and banks were failing, the Federal Reserve was raising rates and refusing to make loans to solvent banks. By the way, this is insolvent banks. Now, this is the point. The bill that it was introduced in the Senate would require the Federal Reserve to certify to Congress, before it made a loan, that the company that it made the loan to or the bank that it made the loan to was fully solvent.
Right. And you can't make a loan to a bank unless it's fully solvent, then that'd be like a banker not giving you a loan on a house unless you had the cash to put down as all of the money anyway.
And so the point in this is that there is, I think probably there's some, at least two people in the Senate who haven't read much history, because that was precisely the argument that was made in the late 1929, 1930, up until 1934 by the members of the Federal Reserve. The argument was that they shouldn't be bailing out banks and organizations that were failing. They should only loan money to the healthy ones, which is, by the way, banks tend to do that in commercial activities. And, of course, what this did is it resulted in, literally, the Great Depression.
I'm not sure how I feel about the money that was loaned from TARP by the government, not by the Fed, to General Motors and to Chrysler. I am sure how I feel about the Bear Stearns loan and the AIG loan Those are things that they're nuanced. It's hard to say, oh, I like that they spent this money on these companies that were making trouble. But those are the nuanced things. Let's move those aside for a second. Let's step into the bankroll in general. If you have deposits at a bank, your deposits are supposed to be safe. If you go after you're finished with your work and the money's been deposited there, you expect to be able to go and withdraw your money whenever you want. That's the idea of the bank. You're keeping it safe. They're paying you a little bit of money, not very much money, but they're keeping it safe. That bank's safety is completely dependent on the confidence of the people that keep their money there. All it takes is a little rumor, and you can have a run on the bank. We've had them so many times throughout history that it is not a question of if, but when. When you have runs on the bank, if you don't have some method to get money to that bank, the bank fails and all the money that was there disappears. Because as Jimmy Stewart said so well in It's a Wonderful Life, your money's not here. It's in Joe's house. It's in Bill's house. Mm-hmm. That's the way banks work. If you don't have a lender of last resort, then you need Jimmy Stewart to stand in front of the mob.
And he's dead.
And he's dead.
Right.
So the lender of last resort charges the bank money to do this. But they loan them money so that if there is a run on the bank, you don't lose yours. And that, there is a conspiracy involved here. People talk about conspiracy theories. There is a conspiracy here. It is absolutely true. It was written into the law. Because the Federal Reserve doesn't like to tell people when it's doing this. Because if it tells people that it's making a big loan to a bank that may be failing, and you have your money there, you're likely to go, well, I'm going to go get my money out of that bank. And you take that concept, and the bank goes away when it wouldn't have.
Right. And that actually did happen when a senator, I don't remember which one it was, released the fact that, I don't remember which bank it was, but one of them, that the Federal Reserve
was bailing
them out.
It caused
and
a run,
a
on,
run
the bank.
On the bank, and it caused the FDIC to have to seize the bank. And
that costs money to the federal government.
Right.
If you can earn money by loaning money to these banks and have the FDIC come in and slowly take them over, what that does is it makes all the people that have deposits at the bank whole. They get their money back, and the bank assets are split up and sold to other banks. This is a different area than like General Motors, Chrysler, where the government said, I'm going to give you money because people depend on you because you buy parts for them and so on. I mean, it's true. It was an emergency, and they did that. It probably was good for the economy, but the impact was that the U.S. government bought a private institution. I'm not so happy with that.
Well, now, General Motors did declare bankruptcy. And what the government did is assisted through it. Now, this is my perspective. When you look at what was going on at General Motors and Chrysler, and you realize that if the number of companies, since we were at that point down to three major automobile manufacturers based in the United States, admittedly Toyo's out there too, but they're in a different supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the number of companies across the country that would, because of the stresses that they were going under at the same moment,
right,
were suppliers to those companies who would, if those companies just simply went bankrupt and suddenly shut down, the number of companies that would shut down, and the number of companies that would shut down because those companies shut down, and the number of companies would shut down because of those companies shutting down.
Yeah, and all of that was governmental anyway. So the nuance is there.
The point is, you would have, allowing General Motors to fail would have a near certainty of creating a depression in the United States.
Okay, next step. If you're saying that, where is the line past which the government doesn't do anything? If it's just an implied we're going to do this sometimes and not others, then you have a lot of uncertainty. In the case of Chicago is worse off now than Detroit was before going into bankruptcy.
Absolutely.
And it's much worse off in that Detroit had a state that it was residing in that could step in and help them, and it had a group of people that could elect a trustee to work with it.
Right.
Chicago does not.
And it also has a state that's teetering on bankruptcy.
Right on the edge of bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. If Illinois steps in to help Chicago, Illinois goes down too.
Right. And I don't really, frankly.
So does the U.S. government need to get involved there?
No, wait a minute. It's a different issue here. Among other things, up until this week, so another change this week, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC would not allow a bank to use municipal bonds as part of their reserves.
Correct.
Because they weren't safe enough.
Right.
No matter what municipal bond, which should tell
correct.
You folks why you shouldn't be very reliant upon municipal bonds.
Right.
Certain very, very secure municipal bonds are now allowed as reserve, but not based on their insurance. And here's the issue. If, and we've actually had in the history of the United States, states declare bankruptcy. Now, there's no way they can discharge their debts. They just act as a sovereign entity.
And say, we don't owe you anymore.
And say, we're not going to pay you.
Ha, 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 ha.
And that's one of the risks that are out there. The issue is that if Illinois, if Chicago says we can't pay our bills.
Right.
And says, so we're just not going to pay you. Yeah. Uh-huh. Very frankly, then a lot of the people, a lot of the organ, like if the electric company says we're not going to give you any more electricity,
yeah,
and we may have to send in the National Guard or something to secure that area because
right.
the police won't work anymore.
All the people that have pensions
so,
from Chicago or from Illinois don't get those anymore.
That's
the main problem right there.
Actually, and that's interesting because they're not covered by the Pension Benefit Insurance
Correct,
Corporation.
Because they're a municipality, they're supposed to just be able to raise taxes.
And that's going to have to be dealt with by the federal government, and there's no laws on the books to figure out how to deal with that.
I understand that, and I'm okay with it. Let me ask you a question.
The answer is when it is going to ultimately wind up costing the federal government a lot more money to fix something after it collapses as opposed to temporarily shoring it up and requiring it to be restructured in such a way that it will stand on its own.
I think
it's appropriate for the federal government to do so.
That requires a great deal of foresight because the government of the United States has lost a tremendous number of billions of dollars in bailing out or facilitating the bankruptcy of General Motors. They lost a lot of money.
Well, that's how
they locked it all in.
Big, big argument on that because the point is if you allowed, again, General Motors to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And you allowed all the companies that were clearly going to fail that support General Motors and all the companies that support them and their employees and just the housing failures alone across the country that were backed by the federal government
right.
would have cost more than the bailout, so they didn't lose any money.
Well, I think this comes back to that question of where's the line then? If you have a small business that is about to fail, and
mm-hmm.
the people that work at the small business are about to lose their
right.
houses, and
yeah.
they're about to, and the places that they were buying from other small businesses may go under because of this. The federal government doesn't come in and say,
you're right.
So where is the point? There's nothing written down anywhere. Which
yes, there
means
is.
There is no line in the sand
it's
that
called,
is written.
It's called systemically important. I think it's, I don't remember the last two words. It's S-I something something.
Right.
But it's in.
And Federal Reserve is required to put that together, but all they have been required to do so far is do a study into what that could possibly mean.
Well, they have required.
They don't know what it means
but
yet.
They're required to regulate those organizations, and they also are given the authority to step in and take control of those organizations. And that's another little news item.
So do we really want a bank to step in and take control of a car manufacturer?
Yes.
That's the question. You say yes, but I said we, which means that you just figured out what I was thinking. I don't know that that's
possible. You said do we want, then my opinion is the alternative. There's basically in a society that's as large and complex as ours.
Mm-hmm.
We have some alternatives. The government can step in and say, we are not going to allow any company to get over a certain size, which is a form of socialism in and of itself, okay? If a company gets big enough that its failure would create a systemic threat to the economy and security of the United States, the government could, we could pass a law and simply say any company that gets that big will automatically be seized by the United States government and broken up into separate companies, which is something I don't think we need. On the other hand, we can say once a company gets big enough in its financial affairs, that its failure poses a threat to the security and well-being of the United States of America, then, and that's what the law, as it currently is written, says, then the Federal Reserve will need to regulate that company to some degree and have the ability to step in if it appears that it's about to fail, remove shareholder value. I mean, it's not like they're bailing out the shareholders and the executives. They lose their value.
Right.
In other words, it's a form of bankruptcy, but it's a bankruptcy under which the collapse of the company is moderated and regulated in such a way that it doesn't collapse the rest of society.
Okay. So here is my suggestion, if there are any congressmen out there listening. We need another chapter in the bankruptcy code that defines this. Because right now, if you are one of these companies, the only way you know about it is if you're about to fail, the Federal Reserve may or may not show up. The Federal Reserve puts out these reports, but here's the thing, I see you shaking your head over there. Technically speaking, Microsoft was and is not anymore one of those companies. At its heyday, it was the biggest company in the United States.
It's now the Federal Reserve is notifying companies when they are considered to be big enough financially to be a significant threat to the economy.
But they are not notifying them when they stop being. This is the point.
Oh, they're not?
No, because they don't have to. They only have to notify them when they are.
Okay.
So this concept of a big company's there, say Google or Apple, if the new technology that they're developing is a total bust, the technology companies of today are 4 years away from disaster or 4 years away from being triple mm-hmm. their own size. That's the risk of new technology. If the Federal Reserve says, hey, you're covered in the event that you mess up, we're going to go in and make things right, but all your shareholders are going to go away, but then they take that away without saying it because it's not defined, and that's the point.
Right. Well,
there are a lot of things in here that were begun with Dodd-Frank, and then the rules that came with Dodd-Frank, and I don't think we're going to get definition to this, but it would be a lot easier if they defined a new mm-hmm. type of bankruptcy and gave us the rules for it so that when an investor is getting ready to get involved here or a bondholder is getting ready to loan money, that they know what their risks are. Right now we have this big gray area where if you're big enough, maybe your bonds will be okay. Maybe your shareholder value will not be. Who knows?
I completely agree that Congress should address this in more detail and pass a law, but the chances are they won't.
That you are correct. The chances are they will not pass.
But there's also a great deal of reason for that.
Of not passing anything?
Of not passing anything.
Yeah,
in that
laziness.
No. The issue is, if you go back before the panic of 2008.
I don't know if I can remember that far back.
And you look, and you were trying to, with just the data that existed before the panic of 2008,
uh-huh.
and you try to come up with a set of rules that's going to work
mm-hmm.
without knowing what's going to happen already.
Correct.
The rules are going to hamstring the system. In other words, without TARP, none of this would have worked.
The emergency acts mm-hmm. happening there, I think, are vital. We do have to have the ability for someone to step in and say, this is going to have a bigger chain reaction than we want. Let's slow it down. Let's do a bankruptcy rather than a destruction.
Well, the issue is the bankruptcy followed in General Motors' case.
Yes, okay? It did. It did.
So the issue here is that in order to do this, there needs to, just as in 1907, we had a situation that the government needed to create an entity to deal with, which is bank failures across the country. And they didn't finish the job until 1934.
And they didn't really finish it until after that.
But this is
they're
the
point. Still working on it.
We had a situation where TARP, which was an unconstrained, basically, give the president a whole bunch of money and say,
Treasury Secretary, you can write checks to anybody.
Right. We had this unconstrained situation, and instead of putting that on the Secretary of the Treasury and the president, say, write checks to whoever, if you turn that responsibility over to the Federal Reserve, and that's basically, and by the way, part of that thing in 1907, was the fact that the President of the United States took a big chunk of money out of the Treasury, handed it to the Secretary of the Treasury, sent him to New York, and said, buy bank stocks. It's exactly the same as TARP. In other words, that wasn't the intent of Congress, but Congress had not restricted him from doing it. And that's exactly what happened in the panic of 2008. And so now we got a law that basically says the Federal Reserve should recognize, and this is a key point, going into the panic of 2008, we had a system that was designed to address banks and bank holding companies that were systemic threats to the economy. However, the biggest bank in the United States effectively was an insurance company.
AIG.
And the second biggest bank in the United States was GMAC. In other words, when you looked around, for instance, recently General Electric got rid of General Electric Credit, which
right.
is a brilliant, General Electric Capital. The point is, these manufacturing companies had become non-bank banks, and the
right.
non-bank banks were bigger than the
it's
bank
the
banks.
The same thing that happened in Ireland and in Iceland and in Cyprus, and only it happened to companies instead of countries.
The non-bank banks were not regulated. And so
right.
when a company becomes a non-bank bank, it's when systemically it becomes the job of the Federal Reserve to step in. And this is what I'm saying. The reason that Microsoft and, well, certainly not Apple, is listed as a systemically critical company is Apple doesn't loan money.
General Motors loaned money. However, it wasn't the Federal Reserve that stepped in. It was TARP, and it was the U.S. government,
well,
and it was
no.
at the high levels. Yeah, General Motors was not bailed out by the Federal Reserve.
I realize it wasn't bailed out by the Federal Reserve, but they were involved in it as they were with everybody else. The other thing is, and I wanted to bring this up, the bank lobby, not the bank lobby, the insurance lobby is hammering right now, and by the way, they're one of the largest lobbying dollar-wise organizations in the country, is trying to get the law changed to keep the Federal Reserve from regulating them, despite the fact they are huge levels of deposit holders. Basically, the Federal Reserve wants to take the largest insurance companies and have them maintain the same capital reserve requirements that banks have. The insurance companies, on the other hand, want to not have these huge capital reserve requirements, despite the fact that AIG was kind of the linchpin of the collapse in 2008, and a number of other companies would have gone bankrupt except for the fact they were bailed out by the Federal Reserve. So we're seeing some pushback against the very elements that were put in place to prevent us needing to go to some kind of ad hoc president writing checks situation in Congress. And I think it's pretty fascinating, by the way, and if you have the opportunity to oppose it, I would recommend you oppose weakening the regulations. I know the insurance companies want to have their profits, and they want to take deposits and guarantee interest rates without any FDIC or any federal backing, and they also don't want to be regulated by the feds. They just want to guarantee really high interest rates. But that's
right. We've got some commercials
to
play.
Okay, we'll be back on the other side after these commercials. This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Are you living with...
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And once again, I have to issue a disclaimer that last commercial about get rich quick using nobody's money is not something we endorse, support, or condone. It doesn't work that way, folks. And I realize somebody may get angry at us about that, but that's all right. We have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, I'm going to warn you that you're probably not going to be able to hear us on the phone.
You'll have to listen to the radio.
Okay, you'll have to hear us on the radio, but you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Could you talk about the Import-Export Bank a little bit? It's been in the news here
sure.
lately.
Glad to. But that's one I happen to know fairly well. Okay.
Do you have anything? Well, I guess that was the question about the
yeah.
Import-Export Bank.
Well, I can address that really quickly. The Import-Export Bank loans money to foreign purchasers of U.S. equipment for the purpose of financing their purchase of U.S. equipment. So what it does, it basically, if you are a Caterpillar and you want to Burundi wants to have use a whole bunch of Caterpillar equipment, or some company in Burundi wants to use a whole bunch of Caterpillar equipment. A lot of people won't loan money to companies in Burundi because they're in Burundi. Well, the U.S. Import-Export Bank takes a look at that and loans the money to them so that they can pay it back to Caterpillar so Caterpillar can build more stuff. And
if you're Boeing, for instance, if you are looking at selling a fleet of 737s to Thailand,
make it Malawi.
Or Malawi, somewhere. And they say, we want to buy 12 of them, but that would be a significant dent into the capital available in our country. But we'll be able to make this profitable. Here's our business plan. Then the Import-Export Bank is really the place they need to go, because mm-hmm. that money is going to be paid to the United States and
right.
taxed in the United States.
Right.
And the U.S. government makes a lot of money on that.
And the issue of shutting down the Import-Export Bank will do a wonderful job of eliminating jobs in the United States and giving a lot of jobs to other places. For instance, we're talking about Boeing just now. If in Europe, in the European Union, and Airbus, they have the equivalent of our Import-Export Bank in the European Union. And they'd be more than happy to loan money. Let's say China wants to buy a bunch of jumbo jets, and they have the choice between buying them from
Airbus.
From Airbus or from Boeing.
Which
and Airbus says, we will loan you, our Import-Export Bank will loan you the money to buy the Airbuses. And
they go to us, and,
right.
and we say, well, we closed ours down, but you might want to go and look at the pawn shop down the street. They
right.
make great deals on gold watches.
It is the equivalent of when you go to an automobile dealership and you want to buy one of their cars, they usually can provide you with financing that is less expensive than you would get if you went to the bank. And the banks don't like that very much, but when that's the whole issue. You're more likely to buy the car.
You can go to a credit union and still do better usually,
right.
but that's a kind of a nonprofit organization.
Mm-hmm. So the point behind all this is that the U.S. Import-Export Bank loans money to foreign countries and foreign entities, but it really never leaves the country. It just comes back into U.S. It supports U.S. manufacturing to a great degree. There's a lot of places in the world where we would not be competitive if we forced somebody to go find their financing somewhere else. And it's been around a long time. I think it's a wonderful innovation. And I think it's very, very unfair to target the U.S. I mean, it's done around the world. Every major country, exporting country in the world, has the equivalent of an Import-Export Bank. If we were to shut ours down, what we would be doing is basically tying two hands behind our manufacturing exporters.
Right.
And one thing, the United States, it's illegal to bribe foreign officials.
Right.
Other countries, it's perfectly legal to bribe foreign officials.
Yeah, so if Burundi is coming to buy Boeing airplanes or Airbus airplanes, and the French fellow goes over and says, hello, would you like some money?
Yeah.
Then the French company, Airbus, goes, good job, you get a promotion. And the United States prosecutes in the United States
and
for that.
The French will loan them money to buy the Airbuses. And
which still is a funny picture in my mind.
Some of which goes into the pockets of the people on the other end, whereas the U.S. Import-Export Bank has a peculiar way of doing this. Recently, we loaned a lot of money technically to Brazil, to their state-owned oil company, to build offshore oil rigs and to put them in place for all the equipment that went into that. That money that supposedly went to Brazil, and that people were hollering about, why are we loaning money to Brazil when we should be giving money to the people in the United States? That money actually never left the United States. It went straight to the companies in the United States that manufactured this equipment.
Right. There've been a lot of news recently about Peru going more towards renewable energy. A lot of wind turbines purchased there. And they bought those wind turbines from Siemens. And Siemens manufactured those wind turbines in the United States, and the loan that facilitated this massive purchase of lots of wind turbines came from the Import-Export Bank.
Mm-hmm.
It is a lending agency, and it is it has bylaws, it has regulations, it is part of the executive branch, which means that while there is a Democrat in the presidency, the Republicans will not like it, but as soon as there's a Republican in there, the Democrats will not like it. Which means that half of the country always hates the Import-Export Bank.
And it's a necessity. Very frankly, it's a necessity if we're going to do business overseas and we're going to sell manufactured goods overseas. If without an Import-Export Bank, we're really at a significant disadvantage when we're competing with the Chinese, we're competing with the Japanese, competing with the Europeans. And one of the reasons that our exports have grown so nicely, in spite of the fact that the dollar is so strong, one of the reasons our manufacturing sector in our economy is as strong as it's ever been is because we have a healthy Import-Export Bank. And by the way, the bank makes money. It doesn't lose money. And when it makes money, it turns it back to the Treasury. The concept of getting rid of it as a matter of principle is kind of like saying if you have an ingrown toenail, the smart thing to do is to take a shotgun and blow your foot off, which I don't think is an appropriate way to deal with an ingrown toenail.
Unfortunately, the political realm doesn't deal with nuance very well. It's either black or white. It is either yes or no. It is either up or down. The reality of the economic world is that there are unpalatable things that have to be done, like the U.S. government loaning money to another government. But we do it, and when we do it, it doesn't make big news. People talk about the Chinese government loaning the United States money. Well, the United States has loaned the Chinese a lot of money. In fact, the number one creditor of China is the United States, mostly through private financing. We owe each other a lot of money.
Which means we're not likely
to fight each other.
Which was the whole purpose in the thing, anyway.
I mean, this is the idea behind opening up the economic world to free trade. And I realize it's being called Obama trade right now, but this is something that's been in the works for a lot longer than his administration. What's going on in the Pacific and what's going on in Europe, if we can get to a place where there's no friction on the trade between us and other countries by removing all those tariffs that are on things like how long the length of your shirt tail that you're selling is, or whether or not your banana is beyond 3 inches. It costs more or less and so on based on all that stuff. And it is based on every country wants to give its own people the greatest advantage inside their own country. But it's kind of like what we used to do inside the United States when there were tariffs between the states. To do something in Texas and sell it in New York costs more to sell it in New York than what we would have said we needed it to. And when we lowered those restrictions, when we said, hey, interstate commerce now is the realm of something that you guys can't do this. You can't just because it's crossing into your state charge more money for it. You can charge taxes on it when it's sold there. But you can't cause the fact that it moved from one state to another to be expensive. If we do that with the rest of the world, and that's kind of one of the big things that I wanted to talk about because it's hitting the news so much, that the Obama trade thing, it's a Pacific Rim trade agreement, a free trade agreement with a lot of the countries on the Pacific Rim. It's vastly, vitally important, and I use two V words there, to the United States to have good trade relations with the people on the Pacific Rim, because if we don't, China is going to be the biggest power over there. And we're kind of happy with being the biggest power over there, and we kind of need to be in order for our countries, our companies to make money when we're buying and selling over there, in order for us to have the imports and exports that we have. We need to have good trade agreements with the countries around that area, and if our trade agreements are being threatened because China is building islands, then we ignore the islands or we look at them and say, hey, this doesn't mean anything, you just made that up. It's important, and it's important in a nuanced sense, and it's constantly surprising to me that there are people in the U.S. government that are sophisticated enough to understand the nuances when the people that we elect generally haven't a clue.
One of the things we lose perspective on, as a country rather quickly, not to say we're the only one, is the efforts that have been put into preventing us from making the same really, really, really stupendous mistakes that we've made in the past. For example, during the Depression, we increased trade tariffs. We basically shut down free trade wherever we could.
Because we wanted to protect the American worker.
Right.
In the process, and, we put them out of work.
And not only did we put American workers out of work, one of the reasons that Japan went on an expansionist binge was because we basically started throwing tariffs on top of tariffs on top of tariffs against them and the Pacific Rim in general.
Yeah, that's, and they thought they were at war with us already with Pearl Harbor because
right.
they said that our tariffs were
right.
an act of war.
So free trade historically has limited the emergence of world wars. The fact that we want to free up trade more between us and the Pacific Rim is critical. And I say critical because we stand to gain a lot more than they do from manufacturing.
It was approved by the Senate.
Right.
So this is
it's
really,
now going
really
to the
good.
House where our representative will have a vote.
Yeah.
And the conservative, it's kind of funny.
Conservatives are really for it.
The conservatives by nature are for it, but because it's the president who is proposing it is a Democrat, and specifically President Obama, they're against it.
Yeah, Drudge Report had this big thing where it had a kind of a red headline, which usually means something horrible is going on. And I was talking about Boehner talking up Obama trade. And I wish that the media and the conservatives would stop tacking the name Obama on bills that are actually popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because they do it to make it unpopular because they think, I don't know anybody that likes Obama, so I'll put Obama's name on it. Well, if you don't know anybody that likes Obama, it's because you don't have a very diverse group of friends. You should probably
right.
look around at the polls. That's what they're for, because this particular trade act is sitting right smack down in a great approval rating for Central America, not Democrats, not Republicans, the people in the middle that make up most of us, not
mm-hmm.
the squeaky wheels, not the ones you hear about all the time, but the ones that just want to go about their life, make a living, do better than they did, make sure that their kids get better than what they got. That's where we are. If we don't have free trade, then that narrows down the ability for us to pass that on to our kids.
Yeah, it's unfortunate the way the politics polarize, but the bottom line to this is really fairly simple. We need free trade with the rest of the world. And without, and you know, of course, the Democrats are saying this will cause jobs to be exported overseas, and the Republicans are saying, well, we're giving too much power to Obama. And so, again, the two extremes are in agreement that it's a bad idea, which
means usually means it's right.
Which means generally that it's a pretty good idea.
The middle of the road people that look around and they say, well, if you just look at history and you look at the areas that we export jobs, if you look throughout history, generally jobs that we export disappear within a decade
mm-hmm.
and a half. If we're talking about the exporting of manufacturing like we did with China, so much of our manufacturing went to China. But if you look at the electronics that's being designed in the United States by, for instance, Tesla, the boards, the electronic boards, are not being manufactured in China. They're being manufactured with robots in the United States.
Did you hear, by the way, that the bill in the Texas legislature to make Tesla legal in the in Texas?
Oh, that's nice of them.
Was knocked down.
Oh.
And the reason is that if you don't sell it through an established franchise, which Tesla doesn't have any of, and
yeah, they do. They do now, but they didn't before.
Basically,
yeah.
You can't just go around selling Tesla cars.
You can't just
come and
sell stuff. You have to have a
franchise.
Wait a minute. That it doesn't make sense. There's
yeah.
a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense to me in the political realm, which is why I'm happy staying in economics, because it doesn't make any sense to the politicians either. We don't get along.
But there's a lot of good news out there. We've been griping about certain things that are happening. But let me give you an example. Housing starts And housing permits are up between 10 and 14% over a year ago. Now, does that bring them back to where they were in 2005, 6, and 7?
No. No.
But they're up, and they're slowly rising. And there's another thing that I think is very significant, and it's something you probably, there's two forces going on here. Number one, interest rates are probably going to go up within the next, sometime this year, at least the Federal Reserve is suggesting that. We're seeing interest rates start to rise in some places. And I think we've hit the bottom and we turned around. The other thing is, in the United States, we're producing households faster than we're producing houses. And we're coming to the end of the slack. In other words, we're running the houses that were built that basically nobody lives in now generally have somebody living in them.
Yeah.
And at some point in the not very far distant future, I expect that we will be, all the economists will be suddenly surprised when a bunch of millennials go out and buy houses.
Right. So there's two numbers that came out for April on housing. Existing home sales declined 3.3%, and housing starts jumped 20.2%. So the houses that exist, the existing home sales dropped because people don't necessarily want to leave their homes right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's going to change in the summer. It always does, and this is another one of those things we talked about first hour. Seasonal adjustment needs to be improved here because that's when most of the houses are bought and sold, is when people are moving.
Right.
It's generally between the school years.
I think fajita seasoning is probably, the chicken fajita
yes.
seasoning is probably the best
yeah.
one, with a little garlic and salt and pepper.
Yes, we're doing a little seasoning, altering the seasoning characteristics of these algorithms. There's
right.
a little garlic and...
And what's Al Gore got to do with it?
Algorithms.
Yes.
Yes. So we're about out of time for this week. We've had a great time.
We've had a great time, but we're about out of it?
Yeah, we're about out of it.
So it'll be a less than great time?
Now it's time to say goodbye.
Time to
all right. We've got too many songs
goodbye.
Going on. All right. So if you would like to contact us off the air, either for giving us ideas on what to talk about during the program, or if you have questions of your own, we have voicemail available during the weekend.
We do?
Locally.
Oh, 947. Now, this is a hard number to remember. 947-1111.
You can reach that same toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you will see our philosophy, our ugly mugs, and the beautiful people that work with us. You will also be able to listen to our podcasts, and there are contact us places there. Get to learn more about economies
and you can even
finance,
you can even
investment.
Sign up and subscribe to the newsletter we put out once a quarter and confuse people even more.
Yeah, and we maybe I think we should go ahead and go to a monthly newsletter.
Whoa.
Yeah, you're groaning, but
oh well.
All we have
so
to do is
life.
Listen to our own program a little
yeah,
bit
okay,
and write
right.
some of it.
Sounds
you know?
Good. Okay. Until next week, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we've had another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.